Hello, I am Cody Allingham, and this is the Transformation of Value podcast. This show is brought to you by Swarbricks, the first law firm in New Zealand to accept Bitcoin for legal services. The Swarbricks team are Bitcoiners, and they are knowledgeable about the legal aspects of Bitcoin in New Zealand, including estate planning, as well as general legal advice. Swarbricks offers a 20% discount for services paid in Bitcoin. Find out more at swarbricks.co.nz/Bitcoin. Now, in today's episode, I talk with Rabble, a software developer and hacker based in Wellington, New Zealand. Rabble was lead engineer at Odeo, where he hired Jack Dorsey into the company, which would later pivot into becoming Twitter. Since then, he has been focused on building impactful projects and social media with the open and decentralized vision that Twitter originally had in its early years, but which was eventually lost. Rabble has created the Nostra client nos.social and is involved with aho.io, a Maori community tool built on Nostra's predecessor protocol, Secure Scuttlebutt. We talk about Bitcoin, new ways of living, solarpunk, creative work, and what the opportunities are for it all to come together. I do hope you enjoyed this episode. If you want to get in touch with me, please send an email to hello@thetransformationofvalue.com and I will get back to you. Otherwise, on to the show. And are you back in New Zealand?
Yep, I'm in Wellington.
Yeah, yeah. How did you find the Nostra Asia conference?
I thought it was good. I enjoyed it. The first conference in Costa Rica, Nostra was growing really quickly, and it was just like everybody was just meeting each other. And I was hoping for more of a discussion about, you know, where, like, why is it that Blue Sky has doubled in size and added a million people in the last 2 months? And some of that's, you know, community, and some of that's social dynamics, and some of that tech. And I tried to kick off some of that conversation, but it also felt like, on the other hand, it was like there were a bunch of people who were just like, it's amazing. And I'm like, it's only amazing if you're interested in talking to the other Bitcoin folks. If you're interested in having people adopt and use it to talk about other communities, then it's limiting and we're not going to get there. And so, you know, some people got that, which was good, but I think a bunch of people didn't too.
Yeah, that was interesting for me, doubly so, because it was my first real big Bitcoin related event. I mean, obviously there were a lot of Bitcoiners there, but I found it interesting that a lot of the Japanese participants were not really Bitcoiners at all. They just enjoyed using Nostra as an alternative. And I think there was some dynamics there. It's sort of reflecting on what you just said, it sort of felt like all of the aspirations were being pinned on Nostra being successful. And it's from a very technical perspective, you know, there was a lot of focus on the tech and the NIPs and all of the different pieces, but the big glaring piece was like, how do you make it work for, or how do you make it accessible to everyone? And how do you get that social layer, which is a perennial challenge in the Bitcoin world, I guess.
And there were a bunch of people who I felt like they were like, we're going to win. Of course we're going to win. And honestly, it reminded me of like what like Orthodox Marxists used to think. They were like, we believe in scientific socialism and, you know, the proletarian will roll over the world and we'll have a proletarian dictatorship of equality and everything. You know, it felt kind of like that. Like, it's because, like, Bitcoin's been around for a long time. There's a bunch of stuff that it works well for. And some of the new stuff, like Lightning, is cool. Like, sure, it makes Bitcoin work a lot better. But like, there's nothing inevitable about anything. And like, just because it feels better or because you want to believe in it doesn't mean that it's going to succeed, you know.
Yeah.
Guns were introduced to Japan and then they were like, no, we don't want guns. And then there weren't guns for hundreds of years. So, like, other countries could have said, no, no guns. And they didn't. So, like, I think that, like, to me, that was a bit of the frustrating part. It was like the people not getting that their worldview isn't other people's worldviews, and that them feeling safe and comfortable and great is wonderful. Like, it's great that you have a place to do that, but I felt like it was lacking. I wish there was a better job of connecting with the Japanese folks there. The language barrier for me felt really high, as someone who does not speak Japanese. And I tried to follow the translations, and there should have been live translators with the headset stuff that they do at other conferences. I felt like that would have I would have been able to understand what was going on. Like, one Japanese talk, he did the whole talk in Japanese, but he had translated all his slides, and he spoke no English, because I ran into him on the subway like that evening afterwards, and I was trying to say, I liked your talk. Nothing.
I mean, I think that they were quite ambitious, and overall, again, for me, it was the first large scale event I had been to. I thought it was, a good job. Though I can agree that the Japanese side of it and that engagement, maybe there was room for improvement there for next time. But it was interesting, talking to Japanese people. From my perspective, and kind of understanding their approach and sort of how they interface with this broader kind of Bitcoin-ism of Nostra and Bitcoin and privacy and all of that stuff. And I was camping on the weekend, and I was trying to explain some of these ideas. And what I really noticed is that Tokyo, in particular, as a city, it really represents this kind of peak fiat kind of thing. And I mean, that's a bit of a stereotype at this point around cities and their role as a kind of a reflection of the monetary system. But coming out to Western Japan, where I am now, which has got all of these old temples, it's very slow moving. You can barely find a convenience store anywhere. There's this kind of different approach, and it feels a lot more authentic, and a few other things. But it seems like Tokyo was a very interesting place to do it, because it really is a fiat city, and it's always about progress and trying to move forward, and these grand narratives of, subways and skyscrapers and all of this stuff. And it seemed appropriate that maybe it was difficult from within that framework to actually understand something that is kind of outside of that way of thinking, if you know what I mean.
And the other part that, I mean, I really like the glad the conference happened. It was wonderful, and I appreciate that you didn't have to pay for it, everything else. But there was an idea that it was an unconference, but there wasn't structured that way. Like, there wasn't a time in which everyone said, okay, now we're going to break out. Everybody who has an idea for a breakout group, put it on a post-it note, come up in front of the audience, say, I want to have a conversation about this. Say when it's going to be. Like, there was more of that in Costa Rica, and you need strong facilitation for that to happen. And so I felt like it was a lot of people on stage talking to the audience. And I think that maybe that's the way a lot of Bitcoin conferences happen. And it's not my favorite model for a conference.
So with the unconference model, it's a little bit more autonomous. Is that sort of?
Well, it's sort of you basically say the conference talks are not the primary value. The primary value is you getting to know other people and having structured conversations. And so there were lots of conversations going on. There was a big space for conversations and tables. There was the lobby space, lots of great conversations happening. But nobody you could say, let's have a conversation about the NIP for events. Let's have a conversation about the login stuff. Let's have conversation, there was a little bit of, I know there were some talks on how do Japanese people use Nostr, but it was in Japanese. So I don't speak Japanese. I sat there with my phone trying to look at the translation. It made no sense.
Interesting. My reflection on that is that the most value I got was just floating around talking to people. I met yourself and many others The talks were good. There were a few really, you know, some highlights there. But for the most part, I can see that it is about those groups coming together. And in a way, cynically, it almost is like this: the structured talks get in the way of those kinds of conversations.
Yeah. So I would have liked more breakout rooms, more time, more said, okay, we're going to have some smaller group conversations, because there were lots of super interesting conversations going on, but because they weren't on the agenda, they were just people standing around. You didn't, like, lots of people who were there and would have been useful in those conversations, weren't, like, they missed them. So, you know, there's good and bad of it. I'm glad I went. I felt like it was a success, but it could have been so much better.
Yeah, I agree. I think it was a success in that sense, but there's definitely a lot to learn from it. And I think the kind of, for lack of a better word, governance of a decentralized project like this, I mean, there's certainly, you know, books to be written about how to do these things. I mean, the unconference concept that we just talked about, you know, how do you bring people together and facilitate development? Because we had the people in the room, you know, from all over the world. And certainly topics came up that I would have liked to have been part of, things around design and UX, for example, that I think there was enough of a critical mass to have some real solid conversations and kind of move things forward. But at the end of the day, I mean, we were able to connect. I met many other people. And I think in a whole, it was overall, it was somewhat of a success. And I guess probably the only other caveat was that looking at the some of the cheerleading going on, I think there is some concern there a little bit around that this is already won, this is already the thing that it needs to be. A little bit concerning, because I don't think that's the case. I think there is still a lot of work to do. So just sort of zooming out a little bit though, Rabo, I just want to just circle back to our connection with Wellington. So you were, we met there in Tokyo, but you've been based in Wellington, and you've been working on some interesting projects. I guess a little bit aligned with some of the Nostra topics. So I'm keen to dive into what you're working on, some of your background with your current projects, if that's all right.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So sometimes I feel like I've been working on the same sets of problems my entire career, which is, I want to figure out how do we use technology, specifically some sort of social media, people being able to publish events, but also not just like cover events, but also find out about them. So meetup style calendars. In 1996, I launched a website called protest.net that is a activist calendar website. One of my to-do list things is to port it over to Nostr. Now, 25 years later. And then I was involved with creation of podcasting and involved with the creation of Twitter. I believe that we can build technology that acts as a tool to empower people to change the world together for the better. And I think that, you know, I believe in decentralization and autonomy and bottom-up democracy. And I think that we can build technology that rewrites the rules for how we connect and what we want to do. And so I'm super excited about that. And that's the work that originally actually brought me to New Zealand. It wasn't to work on Nostr, it was work on the predecessor protocol called Secure Scuttlebutt, which was developed by some people in the Inspiral Network, and specifically Dominic Tarr, a very prolific JavaScript developer living on a sailboat in the Auckland Harbor. And the Inspiral folks had me come and speak at a conference, and I started meeting some people and learned about Scuttlebutt. And I'm like, oh, this might let us reinvent the openness and the creativity that existed at Twitter. Mm-hmm. Because Twitter in its early days was very open. All the innovation came from the users. Anybody could build an app. There was no permission needed to work on top of Twitter. And all sorts of creative things happened. And then Twitter decided its business model was advertising, and the only way to be an effective advertising business is to sort of shut everything down and centralize it. You know, it sort of, we lost.
Yeah. Oh, I mean,
Twitter. And so I was...
Oh, So I was just going to say my relationship to that. I mean, I think it could be summarized in a word that our mutual friend Mikey uses, which is solar punk, which is kind of this optimistic future of how technology could empower and enable just a better way of being. And that sounds a bit abstract, but when I first moved to Wellington, you know, this time around, and I got to know the guys at Art Hack, and I learned about Secure Scuttlebutt and just the way they approached things, that sort of openness you described, I really felt that just from this kind of group of artists and hackers and creators who were sort of socializing together. And it seems like Wellington was a really good place for that, because it's sort of a non-commercial city, right? There's a specter of government, but besides that, it's pretty much just a bunch of students and kind of alternative people hanging around, making stuff happen. And you couldn't do that in a fiat city, I don't think.
Yeah, so I think that it's easier to do that in a place like Wellington, because you don't move to Wellington for the weather. Like, yeah, on a good day, it's beautiful and everything else, but it's never actually warm. It's always windy. Sometimes it's beautifully sunny, and you're like, this is amazing. But you know, and the water is beautiful, but it's not an easy place.
Yeah.
And the universities help and the government helps. It means that there's, you know, people can get a day job as being a sub-advisor to some advisory council to some expert on the government's thing. But that gives you slack to make other things happen. And, you know, in comparison, you know, in the case of, say, Tokyo or Auckland or Sydney or you know, Los Angeles, these are all cities where people move for their career. They, you know, you move to LA for your career. That's why there's centralization of economic and political power in Tokyo. But in the case of Wellington, people chose to move here and not because it was easy.
Yeah, there's something about that, which I am beginning to look at now through this kind of Bitcoin lens. And certainly, you know, I was there during university and I came back, and this time around it was challenging, because at the same time, you know, I'm trying to find the critical mass of people. And there are these kind of these individuals and small groups in Wellington, but it was still challenging to kind of make it work. But I must admit, as I went on my Bitcoin journey, meeting people who were operating with different paradigms really stood out to me. And, you know, you mentioned Dominic living on a boat in Auckland Harbor, and I met, I have had the chance to meet many people who have that kind of alternative approach to living, a different way of being. It's not just about the work and, you know, the career, these kind of limiting beliefs. So I feel like there were questions being asked about how to be that we weren't really, you don't get to ask those questions in Tokyo because everyone's too busy working, you know?
And in some ways you see that with a dynamic in all of New Zealand, because Kiwis are relatively privileged, and because you have the ability to just pick up and move directly to Australia. So if you want money, then you move to Australia and you make money. Whether or not it's a high paid office job in Melbourne or Sydney, or you're off in Western Australia working on some coal mine or something like that, you know, there's like, if that's what you want, it's easy for people to do. So the people who stay chose not to pursue that. Mm. You know, in San Francisco, when I first moved to San Francisco, there was no work in San Francisco in tech. Like, the dot-com boom had flew up and then collapsed. And so there was no venture capital investments. And so there were still people in San Francisco doing tech work, and some of the companies survived. But, you know, I also was able to rent a room in a shared warehouse for $200 a month at 16th and Mission. But maybe it was $300 a month, but it was 10 times less than that same room would be right now. Mm-hmm. And so the people were there because they were interested in the work and they were interested in the alternatives, and not just a certain level of wealth and luxury. And, you know, some of the folks into Bitcoin are into it because it provides an alternative way of working, or it provides access to the unbanked. It provides a way of rewriting the rules. Other folks are just into it because, you know, it makes lots of money, and there's all these scams. And that's the part of it that's not interesting to me.
Yeah, well, just coming back to Secure Scuttlebutt and that project, and understanding, I guess, firstly, sort of what it is and how it connects with where we're at today with Nostra, sort of what the lineage is between those two projects. Like, when did you start looking at Secure Scuttlebutt? Like, how did you join in on that project?
Sure. So Secure Scuttlebutt is a decentralized social media protocol that's what's considered local first or offline first, meaning you don't need any kind of connection from one person to the other. Like, there's no central servers at all. Each person shares a connection, and the term scuttlebutt comes from a tall ship era, in which case they would take a barrel and they would put all the letters in the barrel. And when two tall ships crossed each other's paths in the sea or in a harbor, they would look at each other's barrel of letters. The barrel was called the scuttlebutt. And they would pass all the letters to the person going the right direction. And so scuttlebutt works on a technology level the same way, in which your phone or your laptop will come in physical proximity to someone else. And they will say, well, these are the people I know. These are the people you know. Do we have any new messages for these other people? And they pass the messages back and forth. And it's called a gossip protocol. That protocol works, but it's quite hard to get started on it, because to get going, you need, like, it is designed to sign up and run on a laptop with a bad internet connection where you might be physically in the same spot as someone you're getting to join. And that's how you sort of bridge onto the network. And that's a very slow process. And so the other thing that caused Scuttlebutt to work, it works with very little, you don't need any internet connection. It works if the internet's gone down. It works if you live on a sailboat. It works if you are on the top of a mountain and only come across someone, you know, every month, and your phones will sync. But it optimized for very low bandwidth and intermittent internet connections and higher cryptographic verification of stuff. And so what happened was it became a vibrant but very small community. And Fiat Joff, the creator of Nostr, looked at Secure Scuttlebutt and said, there are some things here that might have made sense when Scuttlebutt was being created, but now, almost a decade later, don't make a lot of sense. And so I'm going to write a Scuttlebutt 2.0. And that's what Nostr is. Nostr says, yeah, you can have servers, and servers make things faster. And Nostr says that, you know, Scuttlebutt was very concerned about not losing any messages. And so there was no delete and no, you know, it was fragile. And Nostr is like, if you lose a message, you lose a message. It's okay. So there's a very different attitude around it. And that little bit of difference made it easier for Nostr to grow. Mm-hmm. And the Bitcoiners on Nostr don't talk so much about the solarpunk legacy of it. But it really is that, which is like, what is an environmentally sustainable, green, off-the-grid social network and technology protocols that give a sustainable world? We don't reject high tech. We're not Luddites. But we also like organic food and permaculture.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's sort of the impression I got as I, you know, started to learn about it. And, you know, I told you the story. I was camping with some of the art hack guys, you know, at this remote, you know, dock hut out in the Wairarapa. And it was this kind of beautiful, you know, mix of like tech and then nature and that kind of solar punk vision, which I think you see sort of little bits of that come through in, I guess, the social layer of Bitcoin around, you know, go and touch grass, or, you know, these kinds of, you know, mimetics around, you know, that kind of authenticity and this kind of search for meaning. And in the face of, you know, AI and all of these, you know, things, there's a lot of existential questions, I think, being asked now, as always. And people are sort of looking for alternative ways of being, you know, and it's sort of, you can change the money, but there's a bigger question around, well, what do you do now? That's sort of like, and I think that, would you say that's sort of where solarpunk is sort of looking at, so asking those sorts of questions?
Exactly. It's like, it's like, you know, changing the money isn't the point. The point is creating a just society and economy that meets everyone's needs. And the money supply is managed in such a way to keep a certain percentage of the population unemployed. Like, the goal is to maintain unemployment and maintain interest rates at a certain rate to keep the system as it is. And that's not necessarily the best thing.
Yeah, I think that there's often, I wonder this as well, you know, looking at, you know, some of the libertarian Austrian economics stuff, you know, which I explore quite a lot. But I also wonder how much of that is situated in a historical context around the relationship with state and money, which has changed in ways that, you know, are emergent and which those models need to be re-looked at. And I think these kind of bigger questions around work, purpose, meaning start to kind of come out as you know, work with Bitcoin and you see that what the possibilities. But it's not like we're just going to change the money and then all of the other stuff will just sort of stay as is. There'll be this great change, and who knows what other sort of black swan events come into that. But it's like it's a time, it feels a lot like say the post-war era where there was a lot of science fiction coming out that imagined another way of living or a new world. And so you look at, you know, 2001, The Space Odyssey, and, you know, these kind of old Isaac Asimov stories and that, and they're so visionary, looking into a future that could be, you know, we've just come out of this great calamity and now there's a brighter way. And then now, I don't know, you look at sci-fi and TV and sort of the way content is coming out, and it's so dystopian and kind of negative. And I think, and there's a lot of fear underpinning a lot of that. And I just, yeah, I agree. I mean, I think there's questions to be asked, and they go beyond just the money. They go into sort of the deeper recesses.
Yeah, that's the more interesting questions, if we can ask questions beyond the money.
Yeah, interesting. So Secure Sub Scuttlebutt is still floating around. I mean, still a lot of people using it, but its sort of role, you know, originally it was around trying to connect if you're on a yacht in the middle of the ocean, trying to, you know, get messages from people and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
There's this legacy now that's been inherited and taken up by Nostr. I mean, where do you see Nostr going in sort of your experience? Because I know you've also developed a Nostr client, haven't you?
Yeah, so I've developed a Nostr client, Nos.social, and I've been working on it for a while. And, you know, my goal with it is, you know, to make a way in which, you know, we can make it accessible so that we have our own, you know, world in which we can control how we collaborate and what we do. And I don't want to live in a world where, you know, I don't control the means of communications. And I think it's important that people do control their own means of communication. Like, people get a say and they get collaboration, and we can build an autonomous type society where people have empowerment to run their lives. And I think our digital spaces need to be considered a commons, which is that it needs to be something that isn't an exclusive thing.
Yeah.
But is something held in common where we can do business, where we can collaborate, as opposed to saying, well, let's just trust the state, or let's just trust corporations, or let's just trust that we'll be good workers. It's like, we need to democratize the economy where we get a say. And it doesn't mean that, like, everybody gets the same thing. It, you know, people's work matters, people's contributions matter. But I think we can build into this something that democratizes power. And if you look at the creator economy that exists today, it is more democratic and there are less gatekeepers than there used to be. So that's super powerful. But I think we can do better.
Yeah. Well, something it reminds me of is a project that came out. I was privy to have a chance to look at early on with ArtHack, which was the Village Kit, which is these sort of what would you call it, sort of furniture and kind of construction materials built with a sort of a interchangeable, kind of like a Lego type approach for building furniture and that sort of thing. And I remember Mikey showing us sort of, you know, how you could build things with these, you know, kind of these elements, whether it's a chair or a table or a wall. And I feel in a way that that village kit mentality of sort of modular units that anyone can pick up and work with for the foundation and creation of communities and groups, there's something really powerful about that, because it kind of creates resilience at a small scale. And then those sort of autonomous, resilient communities can then come together and build slightly larger entities, or they can split if they need to. But there's this kind of dynamism which currently we don't have access to, for the most part, with big tech and the state.
Yeah, no, it's really true. We don't. That's the part about crypto I like the best, is the permissionlessness of it.
Yeah.
Not very good at asking people permission anyway.
Yeah.
But I'd rather us not have to.
Yeah. Well, it just is a paradigm shift of how you can be. And I think that this is where I'm also very interested, sort of like what these systems look like and how they can function, because there are discussions taking place. I think, you know, you spend enough time working with Bitcoin or you know, in this world, and you start to ask questions about governance and structure and authority and these kinds of things. And I think there's age-old questions that are being asked again now that have answers that are quite different to the way things currently are. And mm-hmm. you know, how do you bridge sort of the current reality of where we're at to this kind of fully decentralized future? I mean, that's a very, very different place. It's a bit of a step change. You know, what are the bridging mechanisms, and what are the things we can't predict as well? I think that's really, really where I'm interested in, kind of finding out what people are working on and how it will change itself, because we're building it as, you know, as we go. And so yeah. We can kind of steer it to a degree.
Well, I'm curious. You've got a Patreon. You are a photographer. You have a podcast. You are, you know, not a software developer, but you're aware enough of this stuff. Like, what is it you would need in order to be using Nostr as a channel to sustain yourself and make money and run a personal business as a creator?
So thank you for asking. I'm very interested in this space, and in a way, before I even knew about Bitcoin, when I was doing photographic and creative work, I always came up against this challenge where I felt this deep sense that I needed to compromise my work for it to be financially successful. And what I mean mm-hmm. by that is, like, it needed to be short, easy to consume. It needed to be kind of influencer-esque content, and these kinds of things. And yet the thing that I found the most success with, you know, when I zoom out and look at everything I've done, has been, you know, I've done a couple of books on architecture. I've done some long format storytelling, and that's been the most successful thing, because it really connected with people. And so there was a sort of, I always felt this disconnect between what was immediately going to get the likes and kind of gain sort of so-called recognition, and then what would actually be financially, you know, what I would actually be able to sell and kind of create work with and create meaning with. And so the big difference, you know, I started doing Patreon, and I'm thankful to have, you know, some supporters on there who, you know, enable me to do a little bit of what I do. But for the most part, where it's at today, I feel Instagram and that really, it's something I have to do, but there's no value for value. There's nothing coming back to me from that. I have to do it to reach people, and kind of that's the catchment for new, I guess, new people who I can engage with through my work.
Yeah.
But I don't get anything back. And starting to use podcasting 2.0 and playing around with like Fountain and different podcasting 2.0 apps and getting that value for value mindset, that really changed everything for me. You know, I did the first episode of this show and I got boosted, and you know, that really was like life changing, because it was only a small number of people who listened, but they got so much value that they wanted to give back. And it was kind of the signal for me that I was heading in the right direction with this kind of approach. And I never felt like I was able to get that from Instagram. And so I guess to answer your question, something like Instagram, something that's designed for artists, something that's creative and visual for mm-hmm. me, that would enable me to create the longer format content and these kind of visual storytelling kind of things in a way that isn't swipe, 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 but it's actually slowing it right down. It's a gallery on your phone of photography or imagery or whatever, that's just enabling you to feel the kind of, it lets you feel something.
It's interesting because, you know, on some level, a lot of the Instagram type stuff is possible on Nostr today, but the media uploads are clunky and the way that they're linked is clunky. But one of the things that's interesting is that Instagram does a really good job of creating a showcase for people of their work. Like, it has the immediacy of the stories, but there's the longer term showcase. And Nostr is so much more like Twitter. Like, once it's gone by, it's kind of like off someplace and you don't see it. But what's also interesting to me is, like, some of the things you describe Instagram isn't very good at. Instagram doesn't have podcasts. It, you know, there's a limit to the length of the content you would put on Instagram. And yet it, I mean, it's where the people are, so it works. But I wonder if there's a way, you know, how do we make it so that people build it? And the other is that, how do we make it so that you can build an audience on Nostr? So with Fountain, there were people enthusiastic about your stuff and they wanted to show you that they were listening, they liked it, they engaged in it, they supported it. Turns out you don't need nearly as many people and an audience if they give you money.
Yeah.
It's like this, you listen to music on Spotify and so little of it goes to the artist that, you know, even if I obsessively listen to one artist over and over and over again, that artist would do better if I just sent them $5. And I'm spending a lot more than that per month on Spotify, but it goes to all these layers. And yes, the servers cost money. Yes, the algorithms cost money. Yes, the labels and their, you know, production teams and marketing and those all cost money. But, you know, the creator receives so little of it because it's, you know, there's Cory Doctorow has this concept of choke point capitalism. Like, there's these businesses that have created choke points. And in Nostr, we could build a system that isn't subject to that because you are held accountable. It's kind of like open source. Open source technology, most of the time, you just use the code that someone else has already created and packaged. But they can't go too far off the rails, because if you really don't like what they're doing with the code, you have the right to take your own copy, fork it, and modify it. Or if they abandon it, you can pick it up and keep running with it. And so one of the things that we are doing is building a social network that kind of is open, like open source. Mm-hmm. Or you don't like NOS, or you don't like some other app, you know, Domus or Primal or Amethyst, then you can install and run your own. Mm-hmm. And you can move your content.
Yeah. I think just reflecting on that, I mean, coming back to the Instagram story, I mean, there is this idea that the medium is the message, right? And in a way, Instagram has created the kind of content that it requires you to, it's defined the kind of content it requires you to provide.
And yeah, and they reward you if you do it that way and punish you if you do it else any other way.
And for example, you know, I've been playing around with these sort of shorter format video pieces, like spoken word stories about 2 or 3 minutes, inspired by Japanese an old format called the palm of the hand stories, which are, you know, about 100 years ago, they were a form of small, like tiny, tiny short novels that were very popular. Yeah. And I've been sort of playing around with those. And there was the comments and the feedback I got, people were just like, wow, this is the kind of storytelling that it just takes you out of just the scroll and the doom scroll and these kind of negative patterns, and it just slows you down for a moment. And I wonder, it's in a way, you know, Nostra and Bitcoin in particular. I mean, there is this very much this engineering approach. You know, it's people who are technical and the rules based, logic based. You know, this is how things need to work. But there is this space of kind of creativity, and it kind of almost comes back to this kind of solar punk thing. It's a little bit more free flowing, where as an artist, you know, maybe you don't want to know about any of that stuff. You just want to be able to, you know, have a place to, you know, put your creations. And it's sort of currently, I don't see it sort of really kind of compatible with that way of creating, if you know what I mean. It's sort of like you've got to get your relays, you've got to do all this and that, and you can't just go to this place and let it come to life. And I can see that with my friends and people that I know, I can see that being a huge barrier. It's like it's a technical task. And not that Instagram is much better, I mean, but it's still like there is a UX there, and you know that you just you upload the photo and then you're done, and it's sort of, you can then go back to creating or whatever it is that you're doing.
Yeah, we need to make it easy, and we need to make it fun. The other part that, like, I think that we need to do is, like, realize that there's this pyramid of participation. And at the point at the top, there's a 1% that are creating things. And then there is 9% of the people who are curating. They're engaging. They're replying, they're sharing, they're organizing, they're Pinteresting, things like that. And then there's the other 90% of people who are consuming. Because I was looking just recently at the statistics for Blue Sky, and Blue Sky has added 1 million users in the last 2 months, which is very impressive. But only half of those users have posted at least once. Like, you know, like the distribution on this is so skewed. And, you know, we forget that that's the case, you know.
Well, that's definitely true. And text-based content is one thing, but when you're coming to something like, you know, artwork or visual work that actually has some proof of work in it, I mean, you'd be familiar with like DeviantArt and these sort of communities, which, you know, certainly a long time ago were very much thriving places for work to emerge. I believe SoundCloud, maybe in its early days as well, had that kind of community around it, where it's sort of, there was a culture. You know, DeviantArt had that community as well, with people, you know, creating, you know, and illustrators and all these people coming together. And it feels like that is a different place than primarily notes and text-based content, which I think for the most part, that's what Nostra currently is a sort of a Twitter with, you know, sometimes photos get attached to notes, but it is very much textual. And that's a different kind of relationship to something that's purely visual, such as Instagram or DeviantArt. Yeah.
But I think we need it to be more visual. And I think it can be.
Yeah. I mean, I'm excited for what that could be. I think there's an emerging sort of latent thing happening with Bitcoin is around aesthetics and, you know, looking at, say, high modernity or sort of the ancient, you know, architecture and these kinds of things, which, I don't know, I look at that and it sort of is heartwarming to see these kinds of discussions, because it talks to a history and a lineage of society, which it isn't a topic. You know, we live in this kind of contemporary bias where, you know, the now is the greatest thing that's ever happened. But there's a huge amount we can learn from the old ways. And again, you know, being in Kanazawa, or, you know, old city, you know, never experienced that kind of growth and destruction that Tokyo saw with the earthquakes and the war and the rebuild and all of that. And there's so much beauty here. I mean, just walking around the streets, it's just like inspiring. And it's like, man, they could build a convenience store where the old temple was, but they choose not to because they don't want to.
There's no convenience stores at all?
Oh, there is, but in a lot of the old districts, there's none. So, like, just, yeah, you know, it's just old, beautiful temples, old houses, you know, small parks, that sort of thing.
I mean, it's funny because, like, Japan has so much that's old and so much history, and yet the Japanese don't value the history in the same way as, say, like here in New Zealand, there's all this concern about heritage buildings, but the heritage buildings in New Zealand are 100 years old, maybe they're 150 years old. They're not that old. And, you know, that's okay. But it's also like, you know, what are we optimizing for? And, you know, how do we find the right balance of what's the right pace of life and pace of social media that provides healthy engagement? And one of the things, there's a study on social media which found that passive social media has lots of negative psychological effects. If you sit there and it's just like boom, 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 it's pretty negative to you. If, on the other hand, you're very active in your social media, which is people are saying things to you, you're saying to others, it's engaged with a conversation, you feel like you are part of it, it's very pro-social. And so what we need to do is we need to build ways for creators, for people to have entertainment, but that is pro-social, which is like, it's engaging. You feel seen and you get to see others as opposed to just racking up the likes. And if people are just able to pay for it, then maybe we don't need a million people listening to your podcast in order for you to make a living making it.
Yeah. Well, just reflecting on that, just a small group I have on Signal with a bunch of my artist friends, you know, these are all people that I know in real life. It's sort of an extension of the Patreon in a way, but I find that, I mean, that really helped me get through the COVID years and a few other things, because I just had this group and it was only like 20 or 30 people where we shared what we were working on. We shared sort of projects and things that we were inspired by. And because it's such a small group, you know, there wasn't this huge timeline of stuff to scroll through. It was just like, hey guys, here's a work in progress. And you could be quite open about it. And I wonder whether we're going to see this move more towards these kind of niche micro communities of highly aligned people globally. And, you know, we can share what we're working on. We can be open and honest about projects and things. You know, from an artist's perspective, it's like being able to show what I'm working on and get some feedback is really important, but I wouldn't want to show that to the whole world. And currently that's kind of the model. It's like, it's either to everyone or it's to no one. But having this kind of granularity around the size of the communities and having ownership there, you know, I don't want that stored in some server somewhere. I want that to be pretty minimal if possible, so that, you know.
Absolutely.
Quickly, Rebel, I was also wanting to chat a little bit about the Aho project that you you mentioned to me. Is that something you can talk about?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Aho project is actually a scuttlebutt project, and the idea behind it is to use decentralized tech and secure scuttlebutt to build a network for people sharing stuff about their, you know, it's a Maori project for people sharing about their family, their identity, their genealogy, and so that people can understand without going to the New Zealand government or going to the iwi corporations in a Maori way, where do you locate yourself in this world? And so, you know, people go in and then they cross sign messages saying, you know, these are the people in my family, these are the people who are my friends, these are the people I know. And then it creates all this nested encrypted groups. And because it's decentralized, they put these things called pubs, which are little microcomputers inside Marais, so that as people go into the Marai, the Maori community centers, the cultural center, church, community center, civic center, you go in and then your data syncs back and forth. But you don't have to trust the Marai to stay around, because when you meet other people there, your data syncs back and forth. And so people get access to being able to collaborate in ways that they couldn't before. And it's a really inspiring project. And I'm super excited about it because it lets people engage in, you know, their life and their world in a way that's very powerful and is self-sovereign. But not self-sovereign in an individualist way, a self-sovereign in a community way.
Yeah, that's really powerful. I mean, I'm just looking here. It's, you know, keep track of whānau whakapapa information. You know, the kind of the thing that was originally, say, verbally transmitted is able to be stored in these decentralized systems. And there's something really powerful about what you said, that this is a self-sovereignty at a community level, because I think all too often the information and the kind of resources have this kind of very, you know, individualist kind of objectivist kind of approach to the self, whereas a lot of communities around the world, and certainly even Japan and other countries, have societies that are, you know, structured at a more of a communal or family level. And I mean, Bitcoin, I think, fits into this piece as well, around self-sovereignty, around the financial side of things as well. But I mean, this is a super interesting project. So how long has this Aho project been around for?
It's been around for 4 or 5 years. So they get funding and they work on it, and then they run out of funding and they don't work on it, and then they get more funding. The idea is that it is, you know, it is a Maori-created, Maori-led project to build indigenous technology using decentralized tech. And, you know, that is just, to me, really wonderful, because it's about building a world that's better for everyone. And then we can learn from it, because, you know, one of my experiences as an immigrant to New Zealand is how the entire country is a process of mixing immigrant values with Maori culture and values, and figuring out how to balance it and how to have them all exist together and not have one obliterate the other. And so, you know, I've talked to people in Mapuche in southern Argentina and Chile who are interested in using Aho because of its offline nature, and because they're also looking for that technology and cultural autonomy.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think that I mean, there's a whole history around how New Zealand has formed socially, and sort of the negotiation that's taken us to where we are today. And a common theme that does come up on this podcast is, I think, the hope and the optimism that certainly I have for a Maori approach to financial sovereignty, cultural sovereignty, different ideas that currently they kind of get co-opted by the involvement of the state. And so money is a great example, where you've got the Reserve Bank kind of, you know, let's decolonize everything except the money is kind of the vibe I get. There's this kind of imbalance, and it doesn't even reflect even sort of the approach to things like koha, you know, and kind of what would be translated as like donation. But, you know, what does koha mean? How did that work historically? Because I think there's some similarities around value for value that we can learn from, and kind of applying tech to that can be like a real powerful synthesis.
Absolutely. One of the Aho projects that hasn't been finished yet, but is in progress, is to actually make it so that you can use Aho identities to open accounts with Maori banks, you know, and say that, okay, how do we make it so that people are able to, you know, not rely on the New Zealand government to identify who people are? And because that's not the way in which a trust system works. You know, there's so much of the Maori cultural trust system, which in the New Zealand government distrusts. They call it gangs, they call it, you know, they do all these things where, you know, from the outside, it's people coming together with strong kinship and trust ties, trying to figure out economic alternatives, and who have been excluded by the state in many ways. And so, you know, is some of it illegal? Absolutely. But, it, you know, so was the dispossession of Maori land in New Zealand.
Yeah. And it's also, I think, one of the dangerous kind of paths that you set with a technology-led approach to things is there's almost this cleansing of any sort of remaining culture or remaining value systems, and this sort of pristine engineered future where, you know, there is no possibility for alternative ways of organizing, you know, because ultimately there's something very humanist about small communities And, you know, there's something very humanist about having cultural traditions in at the very least. And in a purely engineered, programmatic, kind of logical world, you know, where all of those things are hindrances, I don't know if, you know, do I choose Tokyo and the subways and the skyscrapers, or would I rather have an old falling apart temple, you know, in some old part of Kanazawa, you know, like, I think there's value to be had in both. And you can learn a lot from how those relate to each other.
Absolutely. The funny thing is on Instagram, I guess, are getting shown all these videos of people who go and are buying all these very cheap Japanese houses and restoring them.
Yeah.
And it's really beautiful. I wish I was discovering that stuff on Noster, but it's like, how do we, you know, that's very solar punk. It's like, how do we reclaim this?
Yeah. Yeah. There's something valuable there. And I think that kind of the cap of the state intervention kind of stops a lot of that emerging, because I mean, I was talking to Obi from, you know, Fediment, and trying to understand, you know, how something could work, you know, from a Maori perspective, you know, with the guardians and you know, small Fediment instances running, you know, how that could work as well, which sort of feeds into what you're looking at with Aho. And it's certainly very exciting, you know. And you know, what would a future look like where, you know, every marae has a node, a Bitcoin node running, every marae has an Aho pub unit going, you know, like there's something really cool about that. It's sort of the old meets the new, and then it meets the old again, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
But I think that's really exciting stuff, Rabel. I am interested to continue the conversation in the future. But for now, I think we've covered some really great stuff. If people want to learn more about what you're working on and what you're doing, what's the best way for them to reach out?
The best way to learn more is to go to nos, nos.social, and, you know, follow the links there. You can install the iOS app and get involved. There are many other ways to follow what we're doing. On social media, and there are lots of different Noster apps, and this future isn't going to get built just by developers. It's about users and communities and people figuring out how to adapt and reuse the technology we're creating. So we need everyone.
Yeah, there's a role for everyone in building this new future.
Absolutely.
So, all right. Well, look, thank you very much, Rebel, and I appreciate your time.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for listening. I do hope you enjoyed the show. I am Cody Ellingham, and that was The Transformation of Value. If you'd like to get in touch, please send me an email at hello@thetransformationofvalue.com, and I will get back to you.